Life can grab a hold of you like captivating strings of color. It is a lesson that four women will learn as they each travel down a journey filled with lies, betrayal, and shocking secrets. Two-time number one Amazon best-selling author Marion L. Thomas brings you her riveting new book, Strings of Color. Critics call Strings of Color real and emotionally charged drama. Get your copy today at Amazon.com or order from bookstores nationwide.
Welcome to Authors First on the Artist First World Radio Network, artistfirst.com. Tony Kaye in the studio. Thanks for joining us, everyone worldwide. If you're an author or independent recorded artist looking for publicity, we'd love to hear from you. Simply follow the links we've provided at our homepage, artistfirst.com. Thank you very much for listeners around the globe, including those of you tuning in on TuneIn.com for your Android cell phones. Be sure to share our content with everyone you know on Twitter, Facebook, and all of your social network sites. This hour, I'm privileged to introduce author D.B. Reynolds, author of Network of Killers. Follow the link we have at artistfirst.com, www.d-b-reynolds.com. Let's give a warm welcome to our guest. How do you do?
I am fine, sir. How are you?
Wow. It's great to have you on board with us. And, you know, I think it's interesting how authors develop a technique of reflection, of going back in time. And you are a screenplay writer. You've written three books now. You've had personal experiences that somewhat less pleasant as a foster child, which brought you to national prominence on a syndicated show.
Yes.
And I think that all of that is a backdrop to what drove you to be compelled to write. This is something you've been at for quite a while.
Yes, it has.
And did you decide after you were on Sally Jesse Raphael, the national syndicated broadcast, that it was time to pen, to begin writing, or you had you already been dabbling in that field before that?
Well, actually, I would say that I was dabbling in it probably since my years in high school. I've always had an interest in English, always had an interest in literature, have done quite a bit of reading, and There are so many stories, because I'm the kind of read magazines, I read newspaper articles, I read novels, I read nonfiction books, self-help books, you name it. And plus, just personal experience of things that I've witnessed coming up as a youngster and even as a teenager and as an adult, I thought that there's so many great untold stories out there, so I thought I'd just tap into a very, very good untold story, and that's what compelled me to write Network of Killers.
Well, especially with the backdrop of your father.
Absolutely.
And his connection with the mob for 40 years as an Irishman and, of course, the Italian mob. And then there is a river in your town that has some notoriety attached to it. So two very strong, compelling issues within your own backyard, so to speak, that
yes, sir.
That really illuminated you and led you to want to learn more and do that research and find out and discover. And it was through that discovery process that you came up with these fictional books.
Yes.
Well, I think that's tremendous. Having a passion for what you're writing about is key.
Yes, it is.
And now, in your other efforts, in your other writing, do you have that same luxury, or you could follow those deep passions, or are you restricted to write or instructed to write maybe on topics that of less import?
Well, first of all, I would consider myself what you call a very multidimensional person. Being that I've read a lot of different literatures in many different genres, and being that I've heard stories, read stories, kind of seen some things firsthand that I've witnessed, as far as, like, I mean, I have a passion for writing thrillers, writing crime, writing fantasy, writing anything pretty much that you're driven by, something that moves you. And I believe that holds true for any author that writes a book. They write about things that they're interested in, things that they're knowledgeable of, and things that just fuels that passion to just want to write something that you know that readers would really be interested in.
And you know, it's great. You were like born at the right time, because computers in their infancy in the 80s developed rapidly in the 90s. And of course, here we are in the third decade of computers. And you are a computer expert. You really have learned that language and have learned how to use the appropriate programs to,
yes,
to express your art.
Yes, absolutely, because I am an IRS employee, so I do work with computers a lot. Plus, I have a PC at home, and I guess the world of computers is always constantly growing. You know, there's always room for improvement and different software programs and different languages for computers. So, yeah, that's another interest of mine, another hobby or whatever. So, yeah, definitely, I'm a computer expert.
And so you're writing on the computer, though, right?
I mean, yes, sir, in a Word program. I do all my writing in Word program.
And that's, I wanted to emphasize that point, because some authors obviously still use the old-fashioned pen and pad, you know, get out and start writing it.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mention that, because even though I do write in my Word program, I do have a spiral notebook that I keep where I take a lot of notes, because there's always thoughts and ideas coming to me, and I want to put those ideas down. And I figure that, okay, some people have programs on their computers where they can jot down those ideas, but I always keep a spiral notebook and a pen handy to be able to, as I incubate those thoughts, you know, I just like, okay, oh, that came to me. I take it to work with me. I walk around with it. Okay, I have it here at home, and I'm always having something that just pops up in my mind. It just goes inside my head. So I say, I have to write this down, because if I don't do it, I'll forget about it. It may never come back to me.
All right, audience, I see your emails. Let me say it again. Minimize your tuner if you're on TuneIn.com on your Androids, your cell phones. And when you do that, then go to the website, Reynolds, Reynolds.com. When you are at that site, you'll be able to learn more about the author, I believe, three books now? Is
yes,
that
sir.
Right? Three books, and it's a wonderful website. You'll be richly rewarded. And then, of course, there's a photograph of our guest this hour, D.B. Reynolds. Thank you for supporting the arts on the Artist First Network, for joining an entourage of over 25,000 guests that have graced our airways since 1996. Famous personalities, New York Times bestsellers, artists of all genre and material. Thank you so much for being our guest and sharing your life, your story, and this work. Do you think that the tragic foster home experience you had as a youth had an influence, a powerful direction in the way that you would, the choices that you would make for your life?
Well, of course, I guess you said I was what you call it, an at-risk youth. And okay, because see, first of all, I'm from an interracial union. I have a black mother and I have, you know, a white father. My father's Irish, of course, and my mother's black.
Yeah, and that wasn't always so accepted.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have made, as of 2012, we have made a radical improvement, I hope, from when you were born and
yes,
your early life.
I think we've made strides, but I still think there's definitely room for improvement, of course. And, you know, your question was about as far as, like, the choices. What really, really propelled me to want to continue to write and express myself as an author is the fact that when I got to searching into my parents' background and found out they were both outlaws, and right here in Kansas City during the late 50s, because I was born in 64, but in the late 50s and early 60s, they were running what is called body houses, you know, houses of prostitution, drugs, cigarettes, liquor.
Wow.
And, yeah, and then I researched my father's background because I've always wondered about him. And I was able to obtain records, his criminal record. My mother's too, but both of my parents, my biological parents, of course, are deceased now. But when I got to researching their background and found out that they were outlawed, and especially my father, when I went down to the Kansas City Police Department, the KCPD, to inquire about his criminal background, they sent off for his rap sheet from the Department of Justice in Washington. And when he came back, oh, my God, I was blown away because I did not know he was into, I mean, compulsory prostitution to burglary and larceny, strong-arm robbery, gas rationing during World War II, hijacking beer trucks, and his involvement with Irish and Italian gangsters here in Kansas City and abroad. And he was just a career criminal. And as I continued to branch out on my research, I really found out a lot, not only about my father, but also about some of the gangsters that he was involved with.
Wow. Do you think that helped? I mean, in a way, to help you understand where you are now?
You mean as far as the point that I'm at
in
my life right now?
Yeah, I mean, you know... You didn't know your natural father on a day-to-day basis.
No, I did not.
Okay. So your experience really was out. Your life experience had been outside of the realm of who is your father? What was he like? I mean, those are questions that every young person raises.
Yes.
And now, shockingly, there in front of you... is a portrait of a man that maybe helped fill in some gaps.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and of course, as your listening audience will find out when they do visit my site, which I know you've already have, that on my author page at the bottom, I have a police mugshot of my father, and I talk about, you know, his criminal career and how, you know, I felt prompted to use him as a character in the book, a fictional character, of course, as far as like a lot of the, you know, the criminal activities that he was involved with. So.
And he was a good-looking guy, and you do favor him. You do have his features.
Yeah, I've been told that on many occasions. Like, I've been told by friends and associates and coworkers that, oh, yes, you definitely are the spitting image of him.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there is a certain personality, you know, just like Sopranos or Goodfellas or Scarface, right?
Yes.
You know, these are dynamic, interesting, complex people.
Mm-hmm.
And you share that heritage.
Yeah, I would say so, because I was... And you know, Tony, it's a funny thing that... that when you inquire about certain things and you talk to certain people, you'd be surprised about who runs in which circles and everything, who knows who. And I got to talking to people in the past. I said, yeah, I remember your father. I know older people, of course, would tell me stories about, I know he was involved with a lot of crime. And, you know, and he definitely ran with some of the heavyweights as far as, like, organized crime was concerned. Of course, with his heritage being Irish, and him being non-Italian, he could never, ever be made into an Italian mafia family, but he was like an associate of theirs. So he did some of their legwork as far as like some of the criminal activities.
The mugshot for your natural father is dated September 4th, 1963.
Yes.
Any significance for you?
Okay, when you say significance, along what lines do you mean that?
When you were born.
I was born October 24th, 1964.
A year later. A year, sir. And a month after.
Yes.
Wow. that's just incredible.
Yes, it is.
You know, to think that he was already so well embellished in this career,
yeah.
You know, as a professional,
mm-hmm.
You know, and that well connected and spotted by the FBI a year and a month before your birth.
Yes.
I just think that's mind-blowing.
I'll tell you what's mind-blowing, my friend, is that when I received his criminal records from the Department of Justice after they were mailed off and sent back to Kansas City, and I had to pick them up from the KCPD headquarters, I mean, not only the list of all the, you know, his rap sheet of all the dates and periods that he was involved in all his criminal activity, but also, like, some of the correctional facilities and penitentiaries and some of these other places that he had went after he was convicted of his crimes. And we're talking, he did time in Bakersfield, California. He did time in Texarkana, Texas. He did time in Illinois. He did time in Missouri. He did time, I think, somewhere in Arizona. So he literally did prison time all over the United States.
And hence the FBI involvement because of the interstate commerce and illegal activity
exactly.
going on.
Exactly. Especially, now, one of the crimes that he was involved with that definitely involved the FBI was him gas rationing during the war. He was stealing gas rationing coupons and reselling them on the black market with a couple of his criminal associates, and he did some serious federal time for that.
Wow. Now, your natural father, is he deceased?
He's been deceased since 1977.
And you're sure of that? He's not in the witness protection program somewhere?
No. He's passed on. He's definitely passed on.
Amazing. Well, at least you have come to some resolution.
Absolutely.
Regarding him and his life. And I'm sure there were many wonderful, valuable attributes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that he utilized those skills and talents in corrupt areas.
Yes.
You know, how much of that is environmental? You know, we won't go into all of that. Maybe you will later on. I mean,
yes.
you did choose to use his persona and his background as a part of Network of Killers.
Well, you know what? That's a strange paradox, Tony, because upon researching his background and finding out, okay, my biological father, who, of course, I was abandoned at 6 months old by them because of the fact that they were running body houses. They were running houses of prostitution and drugs and liquor and cigarettes and et cetera. Because of the fact me, my brother, and my sister were in that dangerous environment, they had to just take us somewhere and leave us. They never came back. Of course, they lost parental rights. But as far as, like, the writing of Network of Killers, like I said, what kind of prompted me to write that book was, as I'm looking at his criminal background and I'm researching himself and then the crimes he was involved with and then a lot of his associates, because in the narrative of a lot of these, the criminal activity he was involved in, it explains some of his associates, some of his accomplices, and a lot of Italian names and Irish names did pop up. So, like I said, I branched out even further, and I decided that I wanted to research these people, his associates' backgrounds and his accomplices,
yeah.
And found out who these people were. And I said that'll come up with a great story, because I'll just tell you real briefly, the crime boss of Kansas City for many of years, probably over 30 years before he died in 1983, was Nick Savella. And one of the, not himself, but one of his family members is mentioned in the narrative of the criminal act, a specific criminal activity my father was involved with. So that right there let me know that he had some dealings even with some of the top crime bosses around this area and even in Chicago. So I thought it would make a great story.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that's what you never really know where all of this will lead or how much of it will play a role in the present work or come up later on.
Yes.
You probably uncovered enough for many books.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's very much possible.
Now, before we get away too far, you're listening to Authors First. Tony Kaye in the studio on the Artists First World Radio Network. D.B. Reynolds, our guest this hour, author of Network of Killers, among others. He is a member of the Writer's Place, the Writer's Lab. He writes for local newspapers, magazines covering many topics. He's also appeared on nationally syndicated talk shows such as the Sally Jesse Raphael Show, and resides presently in Kansas City, Missouri. Now, and you mentioned, too, just in a cursory way, that there were that you have siblings, right?
Yes, I do.
And do they know you? I mean, did you continue to have a relationship with them?
Absolutely.
Because many foster children are split up. You know, they don't have that privilege, but you were kept together.
Right, absolutely. And my older brother and older sister, we still keep in touch, and we're very much... Pretty much have a good cohesion with one another.
Yeah, and now they know, right? I mean,
yes,
you've done all this work, and now you've shared it with them.
Yes, I have.
So that's, you know, who wants that surprise? Oh,
yes.
little brother's writing a book, right? And then we don't know anything about it, and then surprise, you know.
Yes.
But you were in correspondence with them, and they knew the your career, your writing, your research, and what you were unearthing at that time. I imagine it was a pretty big shocker for them as well.
Yeah, well, they've always known that I have an appreciation for, like, expressing myself and creativity and writing and doing a lot of reading, which they do themselves. And, you know, so they pretty much was supportive and, you know, told me to pretty much continue with it because you never know where it may take you. But they pretty much have seen that, you know, that I am pretty serious about this, and, you know, the stories I've written are pretty good. So they just pretty much have encouraged me just to continue on.
And then, of course, we have Bushwhack Charlie.
Brush Creek Charlie.
Or Brush Creek Charlie, excuse me. And we have Master of Plagues?
Master of Plagues fantasy story, yes.
And are you working on another book?
I mean, yes, I'm constantly writing because it's sort of like there's always a million ideas going through my head, so I'm just always trying to be creative, trying to write and pretty much be consistent with it. So, oh yes, I'm still writing more material.
And have you married, children, family?
Neither or. I'm not, no children, neither married.
Yeah, so when you are through with the career where you earn your living, you're able to really devote a lot of time to your favorite extra career, probably the area you wish you would make all your money at some point. But, you know, this is very common for musicians and artists and writers. You know, they've got the day job.
Yeah.
That's how I pay the bills and have a home and a car and all that. And then I have what I really would like to do.
Absolutely. That's right. You pretty much you expressed that correctly. Very much true.
And do you find yourself waking up in the middle of the night? What's your routine? You get inspired, and then you say, "Oh boy, I got to start pounding out some words here."
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, being that I'm an IRS employee, I mean, I could be at my desk on my computer working, and a really powerful thought would come to me. I'll stop typing and I'll take out my my spiral notebook and I'll take notes. I do that all the time.
And you know, the computer, isn't that fabulous that we could, you know, do things like that and remember, and then just kind of catch it and forward it over here and deal with it later.
Yes. Yes.
So you're not cheating the government, okay? It's all right. You know, when you're crunching numbers and looking at forms and trying to help people through, you know, you need to take a break and set back.
Oh, no question. That's true.
You can get burned out pretty quickly on that. I have a couple of buddies that are accountants, and I don't know how they do it. Their eyes are always red.
How that works.
Their eyes are always red. You know, there's like glued to the computer.
Yes.
Especially at tax time. But and do you think that might be a topic, you know, because the IRS obviously have busted a lot of criminals.
Oh, yes. There's always cases coming up against those that are trying to commit fraud and everything. So fraud is pretty big with the IRS and probably other government agencies, too. But, Yes, there's all, you know, we're always on high alert for, like, fraud because, you know, like I said, they say the government gets taking for, like, billions of dollars every year for fraud. So, yeah, we're definitely always on alert for that.
I think it's a bigger number now.
I think it has increased, too, yeah, very much so.
Maybe hundreds of billions, okay?
Yeah.
Thank you for your service to our great country.
Oh, well, thank you. I try to do the best job that I can.
And for devoting your spare time to this wonderful, wonderful screenplay writer, computer expert, writers, magazines. I just so commendable. Do you think that some of this is your effort to give back to the community?
Well, I'm hoping so. I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, I'll be able to make an impact somehow. I mean, be able to, you know, get involved with some things. And like right now, of course, I'm involved with St. Jude's because that's a cause that is very close to my heart. Because to see the little children who are sick and, you know, the ones that may have terminal illnesses and everything, I mean, I just believe that any person with compassion for human life should devote their time to something like that to try to save lives and devote their resources and their time.
And I love the fact you've made your books available as e-books.
Yes. Oh, yeah, they're definitely available at Amazon, Kindle, and Barnes & Noble Nook.
Yeah, I mean, 99 cents. Come
99
on.
99 cents. Yeah, I tell you, the way I see it, people spend that on candy bars or spend it on a soda or whatever, but I think if they spent that on these books, they go to my website and see that they're just 99 cents. I think they'll be pleased. As a matter of fact, I know they'll be very pleased at the literary quality of these stories because they're really good stories. They really are.
Master of Plagues, give our audience an overview.
Okay. Master of Plagues is a story about a young man in New York. He's a young Jewish guy. His name is Stuart Duffelmeyer. Very brilliant kid. And the story begins, the beginning of the story is where a group of his classmates from NYU decide to lure him to a rat and roach infested motel in the South Bronx, and they play this prank on him, this really horrendous prank, and it really, really has an emotional and mental impact on him. So what he does, he goes home, and he discovers that he has this magical Hebrew talisman that was given to him by a man who was very influential in his life named Rabbi Erwin Wedemeyer. And when he discovers this talisman, he remembers that the rabbi had told him that this talisman has these phenomenal supernatural powers. So he consecrates the talisman, and he's granted power over all the creatures and elements of the earth. Every creature, every element on earth, he has power over it. So it was a group of eight of his NYU students who had played this prank on him. So what he does, he uses the power of nature, of animals, and of natural disasters to kind of like, you know, exact his revenge on those people. So it's a fantasy story, but it is really a great story. I got a few people reading it right now, and they're just thrilled about it. It is
story. Now, come on. Did you get a little bit of that from Moses? You know,
well,
where the spirit comes through,
the
death angel.
Plagues, yeah, I mean, with Pharaoh and, you know, with the plagues on Egypt. But I figure that, see, the main character in the story, though he seeks his revenge on these people, he can't kill them or he can't really do too much damage. But he just embarks upon this mission to just basically teach them a lesson. And through the powers that he's been given through nature and through the creatures of the earth, he goes back. And once all of them graduate from college, they all spread out throughout the United States, get married, have children. They believe that he has forgotten what they've done to him, but he's able to speak through these creatures and these elements and let them know in a very discreet way that he has not forgotten what they did to him in that motel. So it's a great story. It's something that really, really will keep your interest. You would never get bored with this story.
You know, and those who enjoy supernatural terror, you know, where spiritual things are happening, you know,
yes.
that's the kind of book this is.
Paranormal,
yeah,
fantasy,
yeah.
kind of along those lines.
And what's the length of that book?
Length of that book, the total pages in that book is 280 pages, I believe.
So it's a good read. I mean, you have time to develop.
I think people would just be overjoyed with it.
Yeah, I mean, at 280 pages, you have time to develop characters, plots.
Oh, yes.
You know, and really bring an audience into the book.
Oh yeah, it pretty much grabs you right away. I mean, it's not like you know, the book is stagnated. You know, when you get to reading, like, okay, well, when is the climax or the anticlimax? If you have the climax, the anticlimax, but it seems like it's always climaxing. It's always reaching another plateau, another peak. And I think overall it's something different, too. Master of Plagues is a very different fantasy story. And see, I just want to mention, too, that, okay, yes, three books are out right now that I have on my website, but these are books that I have been working on for, like, spread out over a course of a few years. So it's not like, you know, it's been done within a short period of time. So they're well-written, well-edited. I think the covers are real nice, and they're just overall well-produced books.
D-B-Reynolds, R-E-Y-N-O-L-D-S.com, the website, Master of Plagues. That's the one we're talking about now, with a paranormal supernatural element, 280 pages. Yes, 99 cents. You've got to buy the books. You have to download them. Go to the website. You won't be disappointed. Tell us about the artwork. Are you involved with that, or do you have somebody else to help you there?
Yes, I have a young lady right here in Kansas City. Her name is Michelle Kinch. She's a graduate of the Kansas City Art Institute. Very gifted, talented young lady, and discovered her on Craigslist. Matter of fact, I went on the Kansas City's version of Craigslist and discovered her. And that was probably over a year ago. And she showed me her portfolio, and I tell you, she is just dynamic. I wouldn't kid you. I mean, she showed me landscape portraits. She showed me covers she's been involved with. Matter of fact, she's working on a mural on a building here in Kansas City. And when I saw her work, I was just really thrilled. I just knew how talented she was, because I know I can't draw a lick. And Michelle has done the cover for all three of the books. And I just think she did a marvelous job.
She did, and, you know, I like the continuity there. That's why I asked if you had done the artwork or someone else, and I think it's so important to have that image, that branding.
Yes.
Well, congratulations on putting together a fabulous package. Network
Thank you
of
very much.
Killers. Now, is that your latest book or your first?
Well, yeah, I would say I started Network of Killers a few years back, before I even did Master of Plagues or Brush Creek Charlie. Because Network of Killers was like, okay, that book, now my other books, it went through a lot of editing, it went through a lot of different drafts, but I tell you, Network of Killers went through a whole lot of drafts, because I think I'd had like, what, over 650 pages of it, you know. And I said, well, some of this, you know, as we say in the literary world, you have to trim off some of the fat. So I said, let me go in and trim off some of the fat, because a lot of this information probably is not pertinent. It wouldn't make a difference in the book. So I kind of didn't want to write a story that would, like, disorient the reader. So I said, well, let me go in and do some editing. Then I had an English professor up at the university to do some editing. She did a real good job, and it was brought down. A lot of it was edited out, and I said, well, maybe I can use some of that material later in another story. But, yeah, Network Killers is the first one that I started on, of the three.
Yeah, you know, and you learn through that process.
Yes, you do.
You know, that's why I asked. Yeah, there's a progression of your own skill and personality, and you know what I mean? You get through that. The first book took a lot of work, research, background, and then just the art of who am I as an author? You know,
exactly.
You know when you're yourself as an
yeah,
artist. Yeah, I mean, you know when you read a Stephen King book,
oh, yeah.
That's Stephen King, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That's his persona. And I want our listeners to know that when they buy the three books, they're getting a piece of you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they get to go, as they say, they get to pick my brain. They get to kind of like go see what's inside my cranium.
Ooh, I meant to ask. Also, I've had several emails. Are you on Facebook, Twitter, social network sites? Do you
I'm definitely on Facebook.
I know some authors, you know, want to keep that private. I didn't know.
On Facebook, and it's open to the public. I'm listed there as Dewey B. Reynolds, not D.B. Reynolds. But I have an author page for all three of my books. And I have a profile page of myself, a personal profile page, but I have three separate author pages, and they'll be able to find it when they go to Facebook. Or even if they go to my Facebook page, Dewey B. Reynolds, they can click on to my individual author pages for Network of Killers, Brush Creek Charlie, and Master of Plagues.
Well, we better talk about about Charlie.
Oh.
now, this is there's a river, right, that runs, and this is in your town.
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, give us a backdrop. Tell us what brought you to this story.
Okay, first of all, okay, I'm 47 years old, okay, and as a kid, okay, Brush Creek is pretty, let me mention this just briefly, and then I'll get into that real quick, but in 1977, there was a big flood that hit Kansas City. And matter of fact, it hit Brush Creek. It killed 25 people. Matter of fact, the major networks came here to cover that story. Okay, now, when I was a kid, there was a legend that was widely accepted that there was a man who was a murderer and he was a rapist, and his name was Charles, but everybody called him Brush Creek Charlie. And we were warned as kids, don't go in those tunnels. Not only will you have to, you know, run from the big sewer rats in there, but there's a man that lives in those tunnels. He has probably killed a couple of people. They say he may have raped a few women, but in his name, he goes by the name of Brush Creek Charlie, and that was a legend that was so widely accepted here in Kansas City. And that rumor, that legend persisted for many. Now, nowadays, you don't hear much about it, but when I was growing up as a kid, you heard it all the time. If you mentioned Brush Creek, the first thing that will come to mind with a lot of people was Brush Creek Charlie. It was this legend or this thing about this guy. He's very unattractive. He's very mean. He's a criminal. You know, the police are looking for him and all this. So the story, pretty much, I'd always said as a kid, to be honest with you, that I want to write a story about this when I get older, because I've been hearing about this legend about this guy for so many years, about Brush Creek Charlie. So I said, I believe that one day my imagination is going to be so powerful that I'll just be able to naturally write a story about it, which is what I did.
Now, were there police records? I mean, were there missing persons or those found to be murdered in a certain way?
Absolutely. I know within a 3 or 4 year period during the late 70s, there were like five bodies. There were some mutilated. Well, first of all, there were two out of the five. I know they were mutilated. They were found in the creek waters of Brush Creek Charlie. But over a course of 3 or 4 years, there were like five women found dead down in there that had been dumped down in Brush Creek. And again, you know, there was no hard evidence or proof that anyone could back it up, but it was said that they believed that this, people in the neighborhood were saying they believed that this guy, Brush Creek Charlie, is the one who killed these women. And of course, you know, the police and the FBI and the sheriff's department, they were all trying to solve these murders. And I believe to this very day, they never did find out who this person or these people were that were throwing these women, dumping these women's bodies in Brush Creek. But you would hear stories that they were circulating, they were running rampant, that is this guy that's doing this, and his name is Brush Creek Charlie.
Yeah, so really the foundation of the story was urban legend.
Urban legend.
That's
I
what
could
I was,
not have said it better. You are correct.
That's what I was getting at. You know, it's just Charlie. They don't know that his name is Charlie or Andy or Joe. You know, who knows? Or if it, whatever.
Exactly.
But it was the whole idea of urban legend that it must be someone, individual, who's perpetrating these types of crimes.
Exactly.
And so growing up, you thought, hey, I'm going to write it. That's fascinating.
So, yeah, and it always did fascinate me. I mean, because Brush Creek was a place where a lot of people went because, you know, it was like, it was almost like nature. You know, you had, you know, you had the ducks, you had the fish, and you had the squirrels, the rabbits, the frogs, the turtles, you name it. And you had a, because Brush Creek stretches from east to west. It's like a trail.
Yeah, it's going to end up in the Mississippi River.
And jogging trails.
Right? It goes right to the Mississippi River.
Exactly.
You know, Mississippi's north-south, right? It's bringing all the water down, and from Missouri, so it's heading east, draining right into the Mississippi River.
And you are absolutely right.
Right. And so it is something that's used by the community. You know, everybody, there's picnic tables, there's parks, there's a place you can go, and, of course, crime can happen, too.
Wow.
You know, do you think you'll stay in this vein of criminal-type murders?
You know what, to answer your question, I think I definitely will because, you know, I've always pretty much have been drawn to that subject matter. And like you mentioned earlier in the interview that stories like The Godfather, Goodfellas, Casino, Carlito's Way, Bugsy, just to name a few
of these
gangster movies. And, I mean, I've always read a lot of gangster stories, fiction and nonfiction, seen the movies, read the magazines, and you name it. So I've always been drawn to that subject matter because I always, well, because I remember I was reading about Francis Ford Coppola in a magazine called Cigar Aficionado, and he was saying that the question was posed to him that, why are people drawn to gangsters? Why are people so heavily immersed into gangsters? He said because he felt personally that these are people that live their lives pretty much outside the law. They make their own rules. And that's the American fascination, the world fascination, whatever.
Well, you're right. I mean, it's the American dream to be free. It's the Wild West. Shoot them
well,
up.
Exactly.
A person can defend their own and make their own way and make their own rules.
Their own government,
build their own empire. Yeah.
Yes, and that's what Mr. Coppola was saying. So I said to myself, he's right. I mean, you know, people say, well, yeah, we love a good mafia story. We love a good gangster story about those guys because they're different. They choose to be different. They set their own rules. They operate their own government. So that is the true fascination with those guys.
D.B. Reynolds, our guest on Authors First. Tony Kay in the studio, thanks for joining us, everyone worldwide. If you love the topic of crime, you're going to love these books, and I'm going to invite the audience also, be sure to check out Crime Beat with Ron Chipsick and Will Harib. You're going to love their broadcast. They bring on FBI, mobsters, people who've written on the topic. It's a great weekly show every Thursday here on artistfirst.com. And D.B. Reynolds, I would recommend you contact Ron Chipsick and Will Harib about being a guest on their show.
Okay.
So we do have a weekly broadcast where we bring on mobsters, FBI people, and we do have two highly skilled researchers, investigative researchers that have been on A&E and many other television broadcasts, radio and television, and they have their own weekly show here at artistfirst.com.
That sounds
so
great.
So you're right. It is a topic that has broad appeal.
Yes, it does.
So congratulations on stepping into the arena.
Thank you.
And for developing such style and class and for devoting some real time and thought developing your characters and getting the background information together. That all makes a credible story.
Yes, it does.
Do you, in your books, try to follow things in a chronological fashion? You mentioned, you know, 1974, 1977, or in the early 60s. Do you find those to be useful tools to help people go back in time and think about?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I think the beauty of it all, too, especially for my novel, Network of Killers, is, like I've told many of people this, I said, I've actually pulled a chapter or two, I would say definitely a chapter out of Kansas City history because there, like I mentioned in the book, now this is mentioned pretty much throughout the book, back in the early 1970s, we had a section of Kansas City that was called the River Key, which was dominated by, you know, Italians. And there was some mafia wars that had escalated during that time where rival mobsters was fighting for turf, and they were, like, throwing dynamite in each other's businesses during after hours and blowing each other's businesses up. So the FBI definitely had to get involved with that. So the book Network of Killers starts out with, okay, as far as time period and everything, where in the early 70s it shows where these henchmen or whatever are hired by a certain mafia family to pretty much do away with one of their rivals' business, basically for the sake of them not wanting to sign up with the Teamsters. Because, you know, we had a crime boss here that pretty much dominated the Midwestern Teamsters pension fund, along with some of those Chicago gangsters, too. And then once, you know, the top boss of that time period dies off, his nephew takes over. And then his nephew still pretty much dominates the Teamsters. And, of course, the government wants to throw organized crime completely out of the Teamsters. But he wants to hold on to the Teamsters because his uncle, along with a lot of them old-timers, some of the old gangsters from back in the 70s, because the story brings you into the early 90s, and because the Teamsters is like part of their livelihood, their heritage. We've worked hard to build this up. We don't want anyone to come along and take this away from us because the old-timers, our family members, our associates and friends made the Teamsters what it is. They made Las Vegas what it is. So we are not going to let the government or anybody come along and take this away from us. And so it becomes like a win at all costs. But again, the River Key area of Kansas City was like dominated by gangsters, and there was like big mafia wars going on down there during the 70s. So I actually did pull a serious chapter out of Kansas City history, and River Key is mentioned throughout the whole book.
Well, you know, we had a similar thing here in Cleveland, Ohio, with the Irishman in the 70s.
Yes, I read
bombings, about that. Now a movie's been out, you know, a book, then now a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I mean, I think many think of the 70s as a time, well, the mafia, but it was pretty powerful then.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was still pretty active and pretty powerful in most cities.
Oh, yes, it was.
Detroit, Cleveland, as
exactly.
You said, Chicago,
Milwaukee,
New York.
Chicago.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so there is a wealth of information for you as a researcher, as a writer, to go back and learn, and then you can, of course, fictionalize the information for your book, and yet it is grounded in some sense of reality.
Yeah. Oh, very, very much so. There's a lot of plausible material that is mentioned in the book. I mean, it's considered a fiction book, but a lot of the characters, the scenes, the dialogue, just everything throughout the book has a lot of things that are plausible. So I'm pretty sure that my readers will get into it and say, okay, yeah, that sounds familiar, or this sounds familiar, and they'll pretty much almost get an idea of what I'm talking about. But it just has so many good elements that brings a good story together.
All right, before I let you get away, Network of Killers, you have a great subtitle. Sex, murder, greed, betrayal, corruption, these are the fundamentals of their network.
Yes.
Wow.
it's some powerful material, and I'll tell you, it's like fireworks exploding off every page.
Yeah, I mean, that keeps the page turning. And
absolutely.
That's, and those who love the read want to get involved with characters, but they want a book that they can, boy, just can't wait to get to the next, what's going to happen?
Well, Network of Killers would definitely do it for him, Tony, I tell you, because it's, I wouldn't say that because I'm the author, I'm just saying it because it's a very, very good read, and I think when readers get into it and from start to finish, and when they're finished with the book, they're going to walk away with something.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to have something to think about.
And now, Amazon.com, Books A Million, all over the World Wide Web. What's the best way to buy the book? And what about autograph copies?
Well, I'm working on that now as far as like giveaways and doing autograph copies and maybe even a book signing. I haven't gotten to that yet. But Again, of course, you know, my website is www.dasindavid-b-as-in-boy-reynolds.com. All three of my books, including Network of Killers, Broad Street Charlie, and Master Plagues, is available on Amazon Kindle and Barnes & Noble Nook, and also it's available at Amazon.com. Of course, all that information, as well as a lot of other goodies, are at my website. So like you mentioned in earlier, that when someone goes to my website, they'll find out everything about me and about my books.
Thank you for being our guest. Before I let you go, anyone out there on planet Earth you'd like to say hello to, or closing remarks?
Well, I'd like to say they're passed on, but I'd like to say I love my mom. I love Aurora Lee Bryson, because they were definitely influential in my life. But as far as like those still in the land of the living, I'd like to say hello to Dwayne Jones and Bobby Nickens. And I'd just like to say hello to everyone out there that's belief in me and support thus far. And we just hope that everything works out for the best.